Well, hello, everybody. My name is Brenda Boss, and I am going to be talking about spiritual care for caregivers for the next 4 days. Before this session started, somebody who's not in the room said to me, how would you define caregiver? And I said, really, when I think of caregiver, I think about somebody who has to spend intentional time taking care of another human being. And so that could be a parent to a child, that could be a spouse to a partner who is not well in a variety of ways. It could be somebody who's got to take, an adult who's taking care of their parents. And it's also people who do it professionally. So that could be nurses, that could be CNAs, that could be parole officers, that could be any the prison guards, it could be any number of people who, as an intentional part of every day or many days, are engaged in the care of others. And we understand that that takes its toll. There's certainly statistics on what that does to the health of the care provider, on what it does to the mental health of the care provider. But one of the things I realized as I became a caregiver, and I'll talk about that in just a moment, is how much it was hurting my soul. And so I realized that I wanted to talk about the spiritual care for caregivers. Now, you may relate to this as a caregiver. You may also know other people in your life who are caregivers, and you've seen them dwindle or deteriorate. And so this may be a place for you to also find inroads to offer them care or accompaniment. So when we think about spiritual care, there are many different things we think about. And we were sort of joking about all the knitters in the room, but the truth is knitting can be spiritual care, right? It can sort of calm you, it can focus you, it can make you feel better. Drawing, any number of artistic things might do that. And another thing that most traditions, most people would say, I guess if I wanted to have my soul cared for, music might do that. So Joy Berg is our musician in residence this week, and she uses a practice called music that makes community, it's also called paperless music, to lead singing. And I love this process, and I know it myself, and so I've asked her to start and finish each of our sessions with some of this singing. And so I'm inviting you to also participate as you feel comfortable. Joy will show you how it's done. So we'll do probably one song now. Is that what was that you're thinking?
Sounds
okay,
good.
And then I'll come back in.
This song originates from Ghana, and it the words "Salam alaikum" are "peace be with you," but as a greeting, "peace be with you." And so "Salam alaikum," "Salam alaikum." I'll ask you to repeat.
Salam alaikum le.
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 Salam alaikum.
Is the answer that you respond with is a shouted answer of ho ya, and like an exclamation mark or almost like an amen. Salam alaikum ho ya. Salam alaikum ho ya. Salam alaikum
ho ya.
Ho ya.
Ho ya.
Ho ya.
Ho ya.
Salam alaikum
ho ya.
Salam alaikum
ho ya.
Salam alaikum.
Ho ya, ho ya, ho ya, ho ya, ho ya.
Salam alaikum le.
Salam alaikum le. Salam alaikum le. Salam alaikum le.
Salam alaikum.
Ho ya.
Salam alaikum.
Ho ya.
So what are some other things that you can think about that would be helpful when you need spiritual care? And they can be obvious ones like go to church, or they could be not obvious ones. So that one was obviously one of the first ones would be music. What else helps when your soul is weary?
Time.
Time. And when you mean by time, you mean time to heal or just?
Time to think, time to maybe meditate, just time alone.
Alone.
Uninterrupted time.
Uninterrupted time, that's also helpful. Okay? What else?
Going to the wilderness.
Going to the wilderness. And I'm guessing you mean physical and otherwise. Okay. So I'm going to say nature.
I'm going to say gardening, especially composting.
Gardening and composting. Good. What others?
Talking to somebody.
Talking to someone. Any others?
Reading.
And really, anything or something that's in on topic of what you're struggling with?
Something light that you can use just to get away from whatever.
Distraction.
Yeah, a distraction.
Good.
I also use puzzles.
Yeah.
The same way.
Along that line, mindless TV.
Mindless TV.
Yes.
Walking your dog.
Yeah. I'm happy to see that no one is actually talking about unhealthy habits, but of course people do those all the time, right? Eat too much, drink too much, sleep not enough, sleep too much, any of those types of things, but yeah. The reason I wanted to give you this list is this week we're going to try a couple of different ways to do things. Each session has a different modality to it. And so I kind of wanted to see what types of things you would think were helpful, and we may give you an opportunity to do some of that in our time together. So this is very helpful. But today's session is about chaos. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about my own experience, and then we can talk about that as part of the stress that comes in a time when you need spiritual care. And caregivers often have a lot of chaos. So as I mentioned, my name is Brenda Boss, and my wife Janice and I have been together for about 13, 14 years, and about 10 years ago, we started to talk about the fact that we had never had children. When we met, we were both in our mid-40s, and I had been in a long-term relationship, but she had not. And once we started talking, we sort of realized that we regretted not having kids. So we were both too old to give birth, and so we decided that we were going to adopt, which is something that we had in our own families and something that we had been curious about. But being in our now late 40s, we started the foster care system in Los Angeles and realized that we were probably too old for babies. And for a minute, I thought about toddlers, but then we did the math on like how old we would be when that child went, you know, graduated from high school, and we knew that high school wasn't the end of the journey. So we decided that we might be interested in adopting a teenager. And we were already training to be foster parents. And Janice, I can't remember, did we take the intensive training before we met our son? Or I think maybe.
No, yeah, yes.
Okay.
It was in the intensive training that they gave us the note to go meet him.
Right.
To go meet this potential.
So in our agency where we were trained, you're first trained how to just sort of welcome a child, an unknown child, right? And they give you sort of the processes and the paperwork, and that you're going to have a team, and you're going to have a therapist, and you're going to have a doctor, and if your child's on medication, you'll have a psychiatrist, all these different types of people that would be in your life. And for whatever reason, we got interested in doing the second phase of training, which was an intensive training on what to do with special needs kids. Not medical needs, but emotional needs. And they sort of said, look, a lot of these kids, of course, have emotional needs because they've been removed from their homes, they've had a lot of trauma, their parents may not have been particularly healthy. You should take this training on intensive needs. And we said, that sounds good. And they were like, do you have a kid yet? No, but we think this would be great. And we really found that training, even though we weren't ready for an intensive situation, was just good training on how to be foster parents. So while we were in that training, they said, we think we have a kid for you. Now, Janice and I had said that we were really most open to LGBTQ kids of color, because those were hard to place, and especially teenagers are hard to place. You know, they use the term unadoptable for kids in that range. And we were like, we can do it. So they said that they wanted us to meet a kid, and they couldn't, you know, out him. They couldn't say it's a gay kid of color, but they said, we want you to meet this child, this teenager. And he's in a home, a group home of ours, with about 6 or 7 other teenage kids, boys. And we've never done this before. If ever you know somebody who's going into the foster care system and they admit to you, we've never done this before, say, you know, no thanks. But so we went to a park and met this person, and he had no interest in us. Like, when we were at the picnic tables, he was at the basketball court. When we went to the basketball court, he went to the slide. Like, he was always avoiding us, and we came to find out that he had met another family that he was hoping to be introduced into. So while we were there, our son was also hanging out and was smart enough to be like, you never meet people who want to adopt teenagers. And so he started to hang out with us, and we were kind of curious about him. And so we said to the foster agency, what about this kid? And they said, really? Sure. Wow. Yeah. Okay. We don't think he's gay. I'm like, that's fine. We just realized that we want to have a connection. And so we brought him, had some visits with him, and pretty quickly determined that he may be a good fit for us. And people had said to us, you know, when you adopt a teenager, most of their behaviors have already come out. So we pretty much know what kind of person this is. And so we can tell you, oh, he's, you know, he's not doing great in school, but he probably could just use some attention. He wore his hair really long so that he could always kind of hide in classrooms. He's one of those kids who wore a sweatshirt every day of the year. You know, but we were like, all right. They said, you know what, he tends to make weird noises in the shower, but otherwise, you know, he's okay. And it's true, like almost immediately we heard him talking to himself and making animal noises, and like, probably because it sounds cool with the echo, right? I mean, and so we were like, all right. You know, and I was trying to think about this, and Janice, I'm not gonna ask you to give details, but I don't remember when it first got hard. Because there was probably, he probably mouthed off to us, he probably disagreed with something, he probably got angry about something, and you know, we had been trained. This is a traumatized person. Of course they're going to have some negative behaviors. And so we thought we knew what we were doing. And we had therapists who were trying to help us understand him and have him understand us. And it was several months of, well, that was kind of weird. Well, that was hard. Well, that was disappointing. Well, that was hard. Well, that was hard. That was hard. And our son started to have a cycle where about every 3 days he would lose it. And we just kind of braced ourselves for it. But it was always tense. And we were always a little bit scared. Not for physical health, but physical safety, but like, when was he going to explode? When was he going to have a bad day? And we would have a couple of good days, and we'd think, huh, maybe it's getting better. And then we'd be like, oh, no, it's not going to. Right? So there was always this thing hanging over our head. So when we had been with him for about 3 or 4 months, we'd gotten through the holidays, which had not been good. But again, we were well trained in foster care, and so we understood that holidays were especially bad for foster kids. It had been his birthday in November, always hard. Then it had been Christmas, always hard. This is generally, right, in the foster care system, these are just hard times. And again, you can understand that. Then we got to February, and we didn't realize that February was a triggering month for him. But later, when we read his files, he had been removed from his mother in February, had been brought back to her and removed again several years later in February, had been removed from another family member in February. And so his body remembered that. And I want you to think about that in your own life and in your own caregiving, if there are anniversaries in your family that your body remembers even if you don't. And so our son was not okay in February. But we were still thinking, well, let's just try to keep it together. Now, 9 years ago, or 10 years ago now, when all of this happened, I started writing a book, which I have not published, but I have probably 15 chapters of a book on spiritual care for caregivers. And I wanted to read you an excerpt from that period of time. And so I'm going to read a little bit of this, and then we'll talk about if this feels like anything you can relate to. So what most of us understand at some point in the caregiving process is that we're drowning. The person has taken all of our oxygen. It's, I don't know how many of you have ever swum in the ocean. I always like to think everybody has, but not everybody has. If maybe larger lakes also have this, but what's really frightening about being in the ocean is if you go out past the breakers and you're beyond that, now it's just swells. And the swells just keep coming. And if you get in an undertow or if you get out too far, this is the same in a lake, your feet go out from underneath you. And now the swells keep coming. And if it's really bad, you'll just barely recover from one and another one will come and smack you in the face. And that's when you start to think, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble because now I whoop and another one comes. And now you're trying to swim to get your feet back underneath you so that you've got some balance and another wave comes. And so drowning is a very good description for the way we feel when a lot of crisis happens at once. And so I had been writing about that feeling in February. We can only imagine what it's like to go down for a third time, to have water cover us, our body too tired to swim back to the surface. Our lungs are full of water, maybe our throat closes. We can only imagine this physical agony. We might have a sense of it, however, if we consider it an analogy for our emotional agony. As caregivers, we may not be able to tell which end is up. We may be surprised by the changes in one that we love. We may not be able to make anyone happy. We are certainly not getting enough sleep. Our to-do list is weighing us down. We realize we're out too far to return to a life we once had, and there is no harbor, no life raft, no safe spot for us to swim toward. We cannot tread water much longer, and the waves are crashing too fiercely. We are drowning out here. Now, many of us can tell stories of this, of one bad thing on top of another, of no relief from the demands of our jobs, our children, and the person we are now also caring for, of a difficult argument with a loved one right before we need to do something challenging for work or school, for the sick child after the car accident, after the dog throwing up, after the bad news from the insurance company. Bad news comes in threes, they say, and most of us say, I wish it were only three. Mm-hmm. When we first brought our son into our home, we usually felt like we were drowning. There were problems at school, demands from the foster care system, doctor's appointments to make. While these things were challenging, we knew they weren't that different from regular parenting. But because of our son's trauma and disabilities and general complications which come with fostering to adopt an older kid, we were drowning. We were emotionally exhausted and physically stressed. We had barely gotten through the holidays, which is not unusual for stressed families. It's not unusual in foster homes. Many of us have an unrealistic expectation of how the holidays should be. Some of us are trying to forget painful holiday memories, or we're trying to recreate some idyllic memory from decades earlier, which may or may not be based in reality. There may be so much disappointment, so many unmet needs. There may be miscommunications or a forced family meal with people who do not care for each other or are outright dangerous to each other. Some families keep trying and some finally give up. Our son suffers through the holidays and his birthday is in November. It was our first birthday holiday season with him and it had not gone well. He felt terrible. We felt terrible. We were also learning how to navigate difficult feelings and bad reactions, which was not something in my family of origin. I had never had anybody raise their voice in my family until my parents were divorcing, and then I heard them yell twice. To make matters worse, we were now entering our first February with our son. It would only be months later we realized February holds several significant traumatic events from our son's childhood. His body remembers these traumas, and his reaction was quite severe. I did not want to go into the details, but let's just say our family had to leave a restaurant before the food came, and I had screamed at him with so much venom I barely recognized myself. We had hurt feelings and shame to go around for weeks. Our foster support team started to seriously talk with us about removing him from our home. My wife and I often look at this exact moment in time as a key turning point in our family. We could have said no to him at that point and felt justified. Somehow we agreed to keep going. And while we had agreed to it, I was really feeling unsettled the next week. My feet had been swept out from underneath me, and I had taken in a lot of emotional salt water. I was drowning. I'm wondering if any of you can relate to that type of feeling and how it feels in your body. Are any of you sort of relating to any of that sort of too much anger, resentment? It's too much. Is that something that anybody here can say? A lot of you are nodding. What does that feel like in your body? And maybe it doesn't now, but when you're in the worst of it, what does it feel like?
Out of control and pissed off.
Pissed off, right? I mean, like I said, I had never screamed at a human being as bad as I did. We got back in the car, and I turned around and screamed at him. Right, out of control, totally. Let me write a few of these down. Okay, out of control, what else?
That's a gut-wrenching stomach ache.
Stomach ache.
Hating God.
Oh my God, preach it. Out of control, pissed off.
It's not fair.
Hating God.
Why me?
Not fair.
What's wrong with me?
What's wrong with me?
But also a sense that you can't have anything wrong with you. I don't know if that's a gut thing at that point, but it's kind of part of what about me, but
right?
I don't
nearly
care.
Homicidal.
Which is nearly homicidal? Yeah, right? Which is so frightening. You're like, who am I? You know what? I wanted to put one more up here in what spiritual care looks like, and I'm going to put it right here. Oops, that's not it. Nope, that's not it either. Do you know what that is?
I can't see it.
It's IYKYK. It's one of those hashtags the kids use.
If you know, you know.
If you know, you know. And what I can't we tell immediately? If you know, you know. The whole room kind of gets it. We got to the point where we could say to somebody, we adopted a kid out of foster care. He has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And people went, see, like just like that. If you know, you know. And so that's actually a part of the story, is that when our son came to us, he didn't have that diagnosis. And pretty quickly we realized that there was something. This wasn't a kid with ADHD, right? There was something else going on. So there was something beyond just troubled. And most of us have that with caregiving too. It's not just she's forgetful. She's had a stroke. And so, or you know, whatever is going on. He's not just grumpy. He's got congestive heart failure. So this is a big part of it. And so I really appreciate that as all you start saying these, nobody goes, what do you mean nearly homicidal? You go, oh yeah. I agree. Right. And so what does that feel like in your body? We had a stomach ache. What other things do you notice when you either relive that or you're in that moment?
Tightness
here, exhausted. And you know, exhaustion is weird, right? Because you're like, why am I so tired? But I wonder if part of it is because we're so tense, right? And our muscles get exhausted from being so tense or having to rush and react and all of that, right? Right.
I find sometimes like gasping for breath, kind of just gasping. And not even realizing I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Or like holding your breath and not even realizing you're doing it. I sometimes numb out, like because I don't want to go there because I still have to care for this human being and I can't fall apart. There's a numbness that kind of comes over me at times, or did.
Numbness.
Ask the question again, please.
What does it feel like in your body? And are any of you having any of those sensations now talking about it? A little bit? That's real, right? Man, this morning I got an email which wasn't about from anybody in this life. It's actually from somebody that I like a lot, and my stomach turned. And I was like, just for a second, like, ugh! Like a tiny little panic. And I was like, what was that? And I was like, wow, my body, right? Okay. I'm going to erase all of this. Is there anything anybody needs to see or remember? I don't think so. But
you need a picture of it?
I mean, I will just to have it, but...
Did you put shame in there?
Yeah. I did not put shame in there, but isn't that a good one? Well, it was a little bit of this what's wrong with me, right? But yeah, that shame piece.
Yeah, but shame for the way you're, for yelling. Shame for...
Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Right?
Being angry.
Or being angry or frustrated.
Not caring enough.
I guess what I think, too, is when, in God's name, is it going to end? This is like 40 years in the wilderness. How long can a person live?
Yeah. Yeah, right? Like, how long can a person live? How long can I do this?
Right. My time's ticking. I'm in my 70s. My husband's heading toward 75, and we're still caregiving.
Yeah.
And people just say, oh, well, you've always done it. You've taken care of everybody. You can do this, too. No, not anymore.
Yeah. Right, I've had it. Yeah. Okay, so now what I want to ask is if it's, I mean, we're doing, this is such a small group, maybe we can stay in this level if you'd like, or I'm wondering if we can sort of pair off or go into threes. And I want to ask you what it looks like in your life. And you're sort of saying this, I'm tired of it. But like, how does it manifest in your relationships? Is that all right? Can we do that for a little bit? So it's a little bit before 2. Let's maybe spend 5 to 8 minutes in sort of smaller pairings. And if you'd like to get outside for a minute, you can. Obviously, if you want to keep knitting, you can. But what does it look like when you're in this sort of activated, chaotic state? What does that look like in your own life or in your relationships or any of that, okay? We'll take a few minutes.
We're a small enough group. Like,
yeah, I would like to have.
You want to hear all of it?
Yeah. All together. Yeah.
If we do that, do you mind if I close the door?
So no, it's fine.
Because the people are sharing the name.
Yeah. Now, I think we can all hear each other. And what I'm doing. Go ahead.
You should probably tell between them.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. We can all hear each other here. This microphone is going to a recording. And so I was going to pass out a microphone for you to all hear each other, but I think I'd be more comfortable kind of repeating back what you say so that your privacy remains in place. Is that okay? And it just goes into sort of hold an archive.
Are we all staying together or are we breaking up?
We are staying together.
Oh, we are.
Oh, just
there was a request that we stay
together. Yeah, as we were moving about, we were like, actually, they'd like to stay together. So let's talk about this, the one that you said. How much longer is this going to be going on? And you said something about 40 years in the wilderness, and I thought maybe you'd been a caregiver for 40 years.
No, my sister and her husband were killed when I was 44, and in a car accident, and I got their children.
Oh, man.
And then there was 7 years of a state suit just because we could be held liable when they grew up.
Wow.
Then we got away and we had a life and I had a good job for about 15 years, well, actually less than that. Probably for the last 10 years I've been doing my mother's medication.
Mm-hmm.
And I tend to be the one that takes it to the doctor. Nobody else does. I have a sister who's a nurse who will not participate, period. And one who's 7 years, she's the baby, and I'm the oldest of 4 daughters, and therefore you're the example to your younger sister. So wait, long and the short of it is, the bulk of the ugly usually ends up on me because I'm not working anymore.
Oh, wow.
But I feel like I've never been able to stop working. So where I find my irritation the most now is my husband is underneath my feet, too. So I've got my mother.
Yeah.
And I have to take care of her. And then I have my husband, who really is starting to have hearing problems, but he will not listen to that. And I think, I'm not going there.
Yeah.
I cannot do this twice. No, 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 no. And so those sorts of things. And since his parents conveniently went either into a nursing home or died before they left their home and weren't as old as my mom is, I'm thinking, you know what? I can't be your caregiver. I cannot be your caregiver.
Yeah.
There's nothing left in me already. So I'm doing the best that I can.
Yeah, you have that sense that you're totally empty.
I'm going to put abdicating, which I don't mean that as a judgmental word. I don't know what I should say instead, but like can't do it. Like I won't do it. But like you've got people in your family who shirk, right? They shirk their duties,
right.
And that some of us have too much responsibility. So right. Those are kind of some of the ways that it looks. Yeah, I don't know if there's a better word for abdicating. But
boundaries? I don't know.
napping.
Well, yeah, also bad, yes.
Although that's, I mean.
Yeah. Boundaries and boundary violations.
And there's roles in a family.
Yes.
Well, you were, you are, you have.
So there's roles.
Sorry, I have needs too.
Lack of respect. Yeah.
But you feel like you have no choice.
Yes.
This is a big one.
No choice. That's huge.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Any others that people kind of say this is what it looks like?
I guess this is related to no choice, but like, you are the only reasonably well-adjusted, intelligent person. So if it's going to happen, you're going to have to do it, or you're going to do the abdication to say, if she dies in the street, I can't fly
right.
to her.
If not me, who?
Right.
Yes.
If not me, who? I mean, that was a big thing with.
Because there's no one else.
My feelings about I can't have said yes and then turn around and say no, because then what will happen to him?
Right.
Yeah.
So making choices came over us in some ways. I mean, that's probably oversimplifying, but
think about it.
Like that, it felt like I'm choosing his well-being over mine. Anyway.
But like in our marriages, we think, well, I promised till death do us part, and I'm taking care of this person. Or if it's a parent, they cared for me, I guess I should care for them. I mean, there's so much relational, either guilt or definition in all of this too, right? We haven't said it, but certainly resentment comes in.
Absolutely.
Either to the ill person or to those who refuse to help you with the ill person, right?
I was a single parent. I mean, I've done caretaking my whole life as a minister and as a private practice therapist for 30 years. And I feel like I've been caretaking a lot. But the thing that comes up for me major is I, as a single parent, well, after a while I had four more kids, but at this point I was a single parent. And when he got to be, 14, I didn't realize that he was using cocaine. I mean, I missed all the signs. He was very good at that. And he came home one evening from whatever it is, and I could tell he was stoned. And I had had it. I mean, I would have sold him to the gypsies if I had a chance. And the only time I've ever touched one of my kids, I grabbed him by his shirt, and because he started to be mouthing off at me, and I slammed him against the wall. And my right hand was cocked, and I said, if you say one word to me, I'm going to do it. And I put him down, and we both just wept. But I had just lost it, absolutely
yeah.
lost it. And, I mean, I went to see my pastor, and I said, oh, my God, what have I done? And he said, you did. You just had this reaction. You have absolutely had it. And that's what fathers and sons do. They just get into it. Because I've said this before, I really think the thing with men is we do contracts. You know, if I do this, you're supposed to do that. Or if you don't do this, these are the consequences. And it's sort of this sort of John Wayne thing that I was raised with, that you know, a man's got to do what a man does, and the boy is supposed to respect the father. And the whole thing just blew up at that moment. Because he'd stolen money from me, but and I finally realized that this guy was doing drugs, major. And long story short, when he got old, I kicked him out of the house. I can't believe I did that. And he was in the streets as a drug addict for 2 years. And it was the most painful thing, but he called me after about a year and a half and said, Dad, can I come home? And I said, we talk about boundaries, I said, no. My wife is pregnant with her first child, and I'm not going to let you create chaos in my life anymore. And I thought, I mean, I just wept. I thought, I may never see him again. But if I didn't let him go, he would never heal, because I was obviously part of the problem. So that's the hardest, in terms of caretaking and setting boundaries and all of that. I just think, oh my God, I can't believe I lived through all that. The great thing about it is that he's 25 years clean and sober, and we are best, best friends. But it could have gone sideways.
Easily, yeah.
And I had to get prepared for that.
Yeah. So a couple of the things that you talked about were the loss of control. Like, I guess I can't believe this happened. But there's reactivity, or we get triggered, right, from something that somebody says that ends up triggering something from another experience in your life. And then this violence and shame cycle that we go through over and over again. And it doesn't have to be physical violence. It can just be, I screamed at my mother. I can't believe I've never, ever screamed at her. And today I screamed at my mother. And now I feel awful. And now I feel awful. So the next time she triggers me, I'm going to scream at my mother again. And so we keep getting this cycle over and over again, right? It's so chaotic. So let me read a little bit more about all of this. And I really appreciate everybody being so frank about the experiences. But as you know, as if you know, you know. So I was in a crisis of faith. Like so many overwhelmed caregivers, I was not sure where I was and what God was doing. I met with my spiritual director, who is something like a combination of a pastor, counselor, therapist for pastors and others seeking to deepen their life. I was exhausted and terrified, and as I describe the events of the last 3 months, I don't remember which one of us finally named what was going on in my family, but it was definitely the right word, chaos. Total, utter chaos. I could picture what this chaos looked like. It was a maelstrom, a whirlpool of color and wind and heat. There was steam or smoke rising from it. It was like lava, hot and ever-changing. It was dangerous and frightening, and no living creature could venture into it. "Where is God in this chaos?" asked my spiritual director. Immediately, the verses from Genesis 1 came to mind. I will read that to you now. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was a formless void, in some translations, chaos. And darkness covered the face of the deep, while the Spirit of God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God said that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness, and he called the day light, the light day, and the darkness night. And there was evening and there was morning, the first day. Well, I said, the Spirit of God hovered over the chaos. And I answered without thinking, God is hovering over the chaos in my family, about to create something new. Well, that is a nice little Sunday school answer. There was a lot of metaphor at work. Whether or not you believe the creation story as a literal interpretation of the first moments of the cosmos, or see it as a myth to explain how we came to be, those first verses of Genesis have some fruit to give us. What existed before anything else existed? The Jewish Study Bible makes this comment. To modern people, the opposite of the created order is nothing. That is a vacuum. To the ancients, the opposite of the created order was something much worse than nothing. It was an active, malevolent, is that right, how you say it? Malevolent?
Malevolent,
thank you. I always have one word that I use that I have to have correction. Malevolent force, we best term chaos. In this verse, chaos is envisioned as a dark, undifferentiated mass of water. This idea says it wasn't nothing. Some people refer to it as a formless void. Other people call it chaos. My family life was not nothing. It was an active, malevolent force, which sounded closer to the truth. Boiling, swirling, dangerous, those words were a more active description. A violent eddy of chaos, and I was barely treading water in the midst of it. Now I was imagining the Spirit of God hovering above that chaos, just to make sense of it. In the biblical story, God looks at that chaos and creates light. As Martin Luther King famously said, darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. But in this creation story, light does not drive out darkness, light comes from darkness. I would suggest only God is capable of such a thing. How can something which is the exact opposite of the other thing be created? It's a miracle. And in my chaotic family, the exact opposite might be in the process of being formed. After chaos comes order. After conflict comes trust. How is that possible? God said, let there be light, and there was light. Does anybody else think it's great that the first thing we need when things are being created is light? We need to expose truths. We have to see what we're working with. We need to understand the place, the limitations, and the possibilities. The only way to start something new is to shine a light on the situation and assess what needs to be done. God saw the light, and God separated the light from the darkness. The darkness does not go away. It's simply differentiated. Not only does God allow both things to exist, but God actually gave darkness a name, night. Naming something always gives it value. God believes darkness has enough merit that it should be given a name and a place and a regular opportunity to be present. God is simply ordering the chaos into manageable chunks. As a matter of fact, it seems this story tells us to expect darkness on a regular basis. Perhaps this is to remind us that chaos is always close at hand, and so is the dawn. God is capable of creating amazing beauty from this chaos. God is capable of creating order and reason and things which can be expected, things which can be counted upon. Chaos is actually not sustainable. Even a screaming child wears herself out at some point. Now, what do you think about that? That the first meaningful, ordered thing of the universe was a day, and then there was a night. There was both. But there was the beginning of creation. There was the beginning of opportunity. You may bang up against that and say, I hate it because it's got hope. Janice and I were in a support group for 3 or 4 years with other families, if you know, you know, with kids who were very, very difficult. And for the first 2 years, I would yell at the leader every time she said, where do you find hope in your family? Stop it! I cannot talk about hope! I cannot talk about hope! And one of the ways that we finally got to hope was actually realizing we had choices. And we'll talk about that, I promise, we'll talk about this in a minute. But what do you think when you think about God hovering over the chaos of your life?
I'd like to know where the light is and how you get the light.
I would like to know where the light is. Fair. Yeah. Right? Because it's still not here. And I want to be really thoughtful about this, and Holden has a policy about this, and so do I, about light and darkness. I don't want it to be like darkness is like bad evil. It's just nighttime, which nighttime is not bad evil, right? It's just another part of an ordered day. And so I really am sorry that I have like brought in the metaphor of light and dark when really I'm trying to talk about the creation of chunking out. Darkness is not bad, hard is not going away. Good, safe is not also going to go away. We're going to have order. Like the beginning of what God does is say, I'm making some order. The sun will rise every day. The moon will come out. Like those types of ordering. And so yes, your point is like, yeah, but I'm in a long, bleak period. Where's the light? Yes?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is you don't know about the length. And that's why I think about the Israelites wandering around the wilderness for 40 years.
Yeah.
You know, in hope, well, actually, they had to worship another god anyway. But, I mean, you know, and you think, I don't know how many days I have left. I don't know how many years I've got left. You know, I have plans, you know, I have plans. And I'm angry about the fact that, you know, I've already got the aches and arthritis and this and that. Will I be able to, will I be in one of these, you know, machines to get around in Europe? Will I even make it there? Will my husband die before we even go? But my mother, as my husband said, she has had already so much more than we may ever get at almost 93. Almost. And I think what I've learned from some of this too, and I've told my kids, I will not do this to you. But it seems like a particular generation of people believe that you should never ask anybody, can you be my caregiver? Will you cut, can you sign up and take on the responsibility? Do you want that? Now, when I was 44, I was shocked that my sister was dead and so was her husband and I had 2 kids to take care of. But I was 44 and not racing towards 72. So, you know, it's hard to swallow. God is out there, maybe sort of,
But if he's got a plan that I don't like, I'm going to stop and like it, you know.
Well, it sounds like so far, right? Sounds like so far the plan has not been one you've liked.
No.
Yeah.
I'm thinking back on your term chaos. And that really strikes me, that term, powerfully, because, you know, as a minister and as a therapist, I've dealt with people's chaos for years. But I wasn't dealing with my own. And I looked around me and I thought, you know, I have so-called friends in my life that make my life chaotic. And I'm the kind of person, because of my own issues, there's two things I absolutely cannot tolerate, is ambiguity and chaos. And one of my dearest friends, several years, his life is absolutely chaotic. And I told him 2 or 3 years ago that I could not be around him anymore, that I would grieve the loss of our friendship. But I said, Greg, you bring chaos into my life, and I can't handle it. You know, I love you like a brother, but your life is chaotic. And so that was a boundary. I had to set that, and it was so painful for me. It was like losing a brother. And I don't know how other people feel about that, but I'm at a point in my life, I'll be 80 years old next month, oh my God. And I'm not going to live the rest of my life dealing with people's chaos, or even my own. So that's a whole new journey for me. I've spent a lifetime, including my own children, dealing with chaos. And I'm not going to do it anymore. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
But I'm just not going to do it. And that means I could lose friends. That means people would not like me because I'm being so selfish. I don't know. But that was my boundary. And how do I know that? I feel it in my gut. Mm-hmm. I can just feel it, like something isn't right here.
Yeah.
And I'm not gonna solve the problem for them. I've been problem solving for most of my life. I'm not gonna do it anymore. So anyway, that's my
solution. I understand where you're coming from, but for some of us,
that's not an option.
Yeah, it's not a friend that you can drop.
If you've got a spouse or a parent that you're caring for, you can't just walk away.
No, I understand that.
So this is the next piece that I want to ask about, and this comes to the no choice part. And I don't have a great answer on this, okay? But I do want to give you this image. So we're talking about this formless void, right? This swirling mass that was the beginning of the world. And God said, I'm going to make something beautiful out of that swirling chaos, and the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to try to get some order to it. So this swirling mass, and I'm happy that there's this sort of round thing here, but when I was a kid, we had a doughboy pool. You know what that is? One of those above ground pools with the metal sides. And it was only my brother and I, and it was probably 4 feet high, but we loved walking around the pool and making the whirlpool. Have any of you ever done that? And you do it, and it's so fun, right? And it's so fun, and after a while, the water's going fast enough that you can be in a floaty, and it's going, and all your goggles and a cup and you know, little toys are all in the chaos, in the swirl together. And it's super fun until you don't want to play anymore. And now you've still got this swirling mass. Now, I'm not saying that any of us created our chaos. I'm not. But what do you have to do when that's going on? Like, you have to get out of the pool. It's like the only thing you can do. You can decide, but it's always important to have that moment of realization. I'm caught. I'm caught in this whirlpool. I can't get it's going too fast. I can't get, so either you got to wait for it to slow down enough that you can get your feet back underneath you, or you have to get out of the pool until it calms down enough that you can go back to the way that you are. And here's where the choices come. What can you do to get out of the pool, even for a little while, so that you can rest, so that you can assess, so that you're not torn around? What choices can you make to get out of the pool even for a little while? Because the truth of spiritual care is sometimes it's temporary relief, right? Mm-hmm. Like sometimes we can't make it all better. People have to die. Mm-hmm. People have to grow up. People have to get out of jail. People have to go to jail. I mean, like sometimes we cannot do the big move that will change the chaos of my life. Mm-hmm. And that's awful, but it's true. If you know, you know. And so, what things can you do? I would argue one of them is what you're doing right now, right? You're either on retreat away from the people that you're caring for, you're considering it, you're naming it, you're telling the truth, you're in a group of people that don't judge you. What other things can you do to pull yourself up out of the pool, even for a little while?
One of the thoughts that come to my mind is just the when Christ was at Gethsemane and was praying, you know, Father, if it be your will, take this cup away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And that so often is what comes to my mind. You know, I guess that's what brings on the guilt. You know, like you, my mother is 93 years old, and I'm one of the chief caregivers. And, you know, just the thought, well, you know, why doesn't she just die? You know, and there's some guilt there, for sure. And yet, you know, you're asking God to take this responsibility away. And the only thing that really will change that is just the daily decision to love. And I guess that's what's carried me through, is just making that daily decision.
And when you don't have enough love, not just you, all of us, right? When we are tapped out, several of you said, tapped out, can't do it anymore, done, can't do it. I'm the only one, can't do it. When you get tapped out on love, what spiritually refills that cup?
Receiving love from someone else.
Receiving love from somebody else. Groups, we talked about talking to each other, right? Because this is so real. You're going to run out of love. Not us in the room, humans, right? We're limited. And I don't know how many of you are believers of God, but God is unlimited. If you don't believe in God, love is unlimited. Not yours, but the whole universe's love. Beauty is unlimited. Music is unlimited. Laughter, there's things that can fill us up because we are finite. I'm really happy to hear that this group says, or I yell at God, because God is infinite. God is not going to go, oh, you yelled at me too many times. One of my favorite stories about screaming at God was I was in our living room and our son had just been insulting or whatever, I don't know, or had just demanded something for the 900th time today. And I was in my living room and I screamed at God. I may have dropped an F-bomb at God. And right then, the neighbors, who were probably 15 feet away, right, were getting into their car. And I'm like, awesome. Awesome. Now, they never said anything about that, but I was just like, right in front of like the neighbors, I'm screaming at God. And they may or may not have seen me leave for work in a collar, you know, as a pastor, that afternoon or something like that. So that's one thing, is I like this daily decision, right? Daily decision to love, daily decision to forgive, daily decision to keep going. And this is the part where we say we don't have a choice, and the truth is, we do. I mean, the other choices are unthinkable. Will she be on the street if I don't do this? Who else will do it? But we do have the power to say yes over and over and over again. And this is Janice hates this game, but sometimes I'll do it. I'm like, let's look at our choices. We could burn the house down in the middle of the night. She's like, that's ridiculous. We could kill him in his sleep. I mean, like, those things are not going to happen, but like, we can make choices. You know, we won't bring him on vacation with us. We will do these things. Like, we can make some choices. And I know that, that many of you have been talking about decades of having to live with this, but what are other things that you might be able to do to get out of the closet? Okay, so you said talk to people, receive love from others.
I think, and I realize this is the nature of the caregiving matters in this, and we may have been able to do this more than some people can, but putting boundaries around what will I do in caregiving and what won't I do. And again, I want to acknowledge that not everybody has the same choices in this, but there were times when once our son passed a certain, well, became 18, we had more options, but so I will do this, but I have limits, not like we're not taking you on vacation because the violence is not going to work for us. So, sorry, you're not invited. Things like that, where we put boundaries around. We came to a point, he lived in an apartment behind our house, where some things had happened, and we said, you are no longer allowed in the house without our permission. You have an apartment back there, you're going to stay back there. If you want to come in the house, you have to ask. Otherwise, you are not welcome. So we had boundaries around that. I know that some people put time boundaries on it. This is when I am available to you. This is when I am not available to you. These are the tasks I will do for you. The other tasks, we're going to get hired caregivers. I know that's not your preference, but that's what we're going to do, or we're going to access other resources to do those things. I mean, and those, that kind of confining it, for me, was a relief. Because part of, and I'll just speak for me, part of my experience of exhaustion was never knowing when I was going to have to deal with it. So it was like I would walk in the house and never know if I would get a pleasant young man who came in and we had a charming little conversation and then it would be over, or I would be called names and threatened, and I needed to have boundaries around that so I could say, I can deal with it now, now I don't want to. And I know that's also not everybody's experience. Sometimes it's just the draining drudgery of doing things every day when you want to be doing other things. But it's just the boundaries around when and how I'm going to do it really helped me feel like I had a little bit of control of my life back.
And this is a really important piece, right? And we've talked about guilt. If I put a boundary down, you cannot call me after 10 p.m. I know you're okay. You're just anxious, or you're just angry, or you're just scared. You're going to be fine. You cannot call me after 10 p.m. You might be able to do that, but depending on your family or the system that you're in, are they going to make you feel guilty, or are you going to feel guilty? Because most of us were told good Christian people are always available. It's just not true. Another thing is, like, can you take time away? Can you have hired help for 2 hours once a week so that you can take a nap? Can you have neighbors and family? And you may not be able to, right? Like, there wasn't really people we could give our kid to. Can you take some kind of respite? But also, can you do an honest assessment of the need? Does mom really need me to sit with her while she watches TV for 4 hours? I don't know. But these are the kinds of things. And honestly, it's like we said at the beginning, in the reading about God brought light. Just being honest about how hard it is might help. You know? Please.
Sometimes just stepping away for a few minutes is helpful.
Yeah.
I did foster care. We had 103 foster children, mostly babies, in a 19-year period. Mm. And one of the things that we learned about babies here is they're fed and they're dry and they're screaming, put them down and walk away. They're fine. They're not, there's nothing's going to happen. All their needs are met. If you're totally exhausted, you can't meet any other needs anyway. Just walk away. Find somebody else to sit in the room with them if necessary. Find somebody else to sit with mom if necessary, and just go out for a walk or go get an iced tea or a cup of coffee, whatever is your preference. Or go down to the snack bar and get an ice cream.
Yeah. So yeah, get a break. Even count to 10, right? Even just like, oh my God, I want to kill somebody. Let me take a minute. and count to 10, that kind of thing. Step out of the room, move your body. That's another one, right? Please.
I think taking advantage, which is, this is something that we did because I got clinically depressed during the wintertime.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. 65 hours of being there nonstop and trips to the hospital and then going to hospital for after throwing up for 4 hours. And my sister said, I think she's gone now. I called the doctor. Well, she said, you get her over to the hospital right now. Might have get her hospital. They take her in. They said, oh my God, she's got this raging UTI. I didn't know old people do not experience the same symptoms as young people do. And as it turns out, they took her to the hospital for 3 days, and she came home with a little cough. And the little cough ended up being COVID. We didn't marry her. It wasn't any of us. So for the next 10 days, I was with her. We were going to the University of Washington, and they gave her the monoclonal antibody, and we went another week and a half. But I think the thing that I found is not knowing when you are burnt out this much, spread out so thin, reacting to this, hypervigilant, you don't necessarily know all the services that are available to you. And I will say this, we don't have people flocking in to see a 93-plus year old woman. They're not there to say, oh, listen, I'll sit with her for an hour, or I'll this, or I'll help wipe her butt. You know, we don't have that at all. But getting somebody, or getting, I've decided I'm going to sit down and I'm going to scour CL, I'm going to scour Burey, and I'm going to scour trauma, and I'm over here.
Yeah.
Experience, and what is, what have other people had with this, I'm going to make a database so that people can have, if you want a lousy hour, because I can get 4 days after a lot of work to find somebody who will cover me, a lot of work. Nobody wants to do that. They want the $30 an hour. You know, I'm speaking about regular people. The agency, they charge probably $30 an hour, and they give those poor people that come in to fill in a little bit. But, you know, there just isn't a system out there, and as the population is aging, you know, I've just decided I'm going to have to start working on something that helps it, not just for me, but for other people.
Yeah.
So that will be about the only action that I can take when I am not there.
And you'll take some control, right? You'll take some control of your own life.
I just want to say that matters. And I'm a social worker, so you know, I really should have known better. Just gonna say that. She chose not to share that because, you know, I really should have known better. But I have now become an FASD specialist. And I can't fix myself. He is who he is. We understand that that is not something we created, and we did the best we could. But I now provide parent coaching and support to people with FASD, and I'm in lobbying for different kinds of services and availability for individuals with FASD and their caregivers. That makes it, I don't know that I can say it makes it worth it, but it makes it feel like this thing mattered, and I can give back. And so when you get excited about, you know what, I needed this, it's not there, I'm going to make it, go with that. Because that can really fuel goodness. I mean, it can fuel something that matters in you, and it can make meaning out of things that feel like you're taking control back in a different way. That's how I
the light out of the chaos.
Take control where you can.
Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
What I wrote down when you were talking was lizard brain. And I think, do all of you know what that is?
No.
So in our brains, and Janice maybe should talk about this, but our amygdala, which is the spinal column piece, all human brains react to threat with fighting or fleeing or freezing. Now there's a fourth, and I can't think of what it is. Anyways, but all of us do it all the time. All mammals do it. But so when we experience threat, right, we've been talking about, we never knew when he was going to come in angry or happy. So our lizard brain, the part that doesn't think, it only reacts, is highly activated. And we talked earlier, right, about reactivity. I can't believe I just screamed. It's because my lizard brain felt the threat and finally lost it. Or went away and got drunk, right? That was like fleeing from it, or was like, I have no idea what to do anymore. I'm frozen. I can't make decisions. I'm exhausted from making decisions. I can't. Those are all lizard brain things. And we want to honor and love when we're in this space. We can't do it while we're in it because we're too busy reacting. But you can't make good decisions. You just can't. Your brain is activated down here, not where it needs to be up in the decision making. And so that, being able to say, when I have a minute and I can think, I will have a resource I can get to when I am in chaos. And so to love ourselves, again, you can't do it while you're doing it. You're screaming. And then you go, oh, that's like base mammal reaction. There's no judgment to it. It just is. Now that I've calmed down, let me do some decision making to take control of what I can. Okay? I want to honor that this is a hard conversation. And you may be stirred up, and you may feel better, or you may feel worse. But this is real, right? And to your point, where is God in this? My tradition says God is here with us, but is being silent and a jerk, right? I love those posters that have people like, where are you? We just want to talk, you know, and like are furious. And yet, to me, and this is complicated stuff, but if you think about the relationships we have with humans, the deepest ones are the ones that have had difficulty, right? Where there's been fighting or there's been disappointment and you've come back from it. I would argue that our relationships with God are deeper because we've seen the truth. We've seen the backside of God, as it says in whatever Numbers or whatever. But we've seen the hard part. And I really have been working a lot in my own life to believe that when God loves us this much, God also disappoints us this much, which is maybe screwed up and maybe, you know, psychologically damaging. But think about the psalmists. The psalmists knew that God disappointed. And we're in deeper relationship because of it. And they were angry with God and were in deeper relationship because of it. And if you think about, if you believe that the Jewish nation was the God's chosen people, they had a very complicated relationship with God. And so I'm hoping that as you continue to explore all of this, you can find a way that there's actually a deepening. You know things, right? You have wisdom that you would never have wanted, right? You would never have wanted to know these things, but you do. What can God do with that? What is God creating out of that? This loss, this anger, this frustration. We'll talk about more of these things in the coming couple of days. But I have to believe that this horrible thing that happened in my life is actually, there's something here. I'm not looking for a silver lining. Maybe I am. I'm not going to say it's a gift. I don't think it is. But God can do something with this miserable thing that happened. And I'm hoping that you can see some of that as well. Because that's the only thing I can say, is God may feel silent, but if you're a Lutheran, you know that Luther believed God hid when Jesus was hanging on the cross. They thought that God was gone. God was actually hiding to fool Satan. So that Satan thought Satan had won. But God was actually hiding in the dying body of God, of Jesus, to do the greatest thing that God has ever done. And so maybe God is hiding in your suffering. That may not comfort you, but I got to wrestle with that. Like, why, God, why? There must be something you're doing. And that's where I get back to this sort of creation and this creativity, and maybe God's making something of this awful mess that we're in. Joy, can you lead us in something else to sing out?
Earth, heavens, rivers, oceans, deep peace falling, God's peace growing. The peace of the earth be with you, the peace of the heavens too. The peace of the earth be with you, the peace of the heavens too. The peace of the rivers be with you, the peace of the oceans too. The peace of the rivers be with you, the peace of the oceans too. Falling over you,
peace of the earth be with you, the peace of the heavens too. The peace of the rivers be with you, the peace of the oceans too. The peace of the rivers be with you, the peace of the oceans too. God's peace falling over you. God's peace falling over you. God's peace growing in you.
Actions, you are welcome to.
The peace of the earth be with you, the peace of the heavens too. The peace of the rivers be with you, the peace of the oceans too. Deep peace falling over you. God's peace growing in you.
I hope you'll take some time with yourself today to breathe deeply, to go find something beautiful to look at, maybe hum a little of that song together. Thank you very much for our time. Tomorrow we'll be talking about different kinds of losses.